I welcome you to the Holistic Health Show. I'm Dr. Carl O'Helvey, your host. My first guest today is Dr. Jane Jeffrey Selle, who is a diabetes nurse practitioner and certified diabetes educator on the diabetes team at New York Presbyterian Weill Cornell Medical Center in New York City. Currently, Jane serves on the American Diabetes Association's Postgraduate Course Planning Committee and is the liaison for the Professional Section Council on Education. She is a member of the American Association of Diabetes Educators Professional Practice Committee and immediate past chair of the Inpatient Diabetes Specialty Practice Group. Jane received the New York Times Tribute to Nurses Award for Innovations in December 2010. Dr. Selle is contributing editor and column coordinator of the Diabetes Under Control column in the American Journal of Nursing. She holds a bachelor's degree in nursing and a master's degree in public health from New York University, a master's degree in gerontological nursing from Hunter Bellevue School of Nursing, and a doctorate of nursing practice from SUNY Stony Brook School of Nursing. She is an active speaker and author whose commitment to professional diabetes education is secondary only to her dedication to delivery of the best clinical care to people living with diabetes and their families. More information is available at http://jjselle1.mydiabeteseducator.org. I welcome you to the Holistic Health Show, Jane, and I look forward to hearing about how a diabetic nurse practitioner works with patients. First, Jane, you are a diabetic nurse practitioner and a certified diabetes educator. Can you tell us about your role with patients?
I predominantly see inpatients in my current role, and I get consults to see patients for one or two things or both. Mm-hmm. One of the common reasons I get called is because the patient's blood sugar is out of control, and the clinicians caring for the patient, often interns and residents or nurse practitioners or physician's assistants, are not sure what to do next to achieve the goal, so they're asking for my direction. Mm-hmm. The second reason I get called, and it can be a combination of the two, is to try and understand why the patient is not able to perform self-care and whether the regimen that they're trying to get the patient to learn is appropriate for that patient. Mm-hmm. So the patient may have come in already on a diabetes regimen at home, or they may learn that they have diabetes while they're in the hospital for the first time, which actually happens quite often. Mm-hmm. But either way, whoever's been teaching them, and many times it's the bedside nurse, they have not been able to get the patient to grasp the information. Mm-hmm. So they're asking for me to come and assess them and see what the difficulties are.
Mm-hmm. Then what is the usual educational preparation for diabetes nursing?
So we have two specializations that you can receive in diabetes, but people come to that certification from many different backgrounds and many different educations. There's only a few programs in the United States that are specifically for diabetes. Mm-hmm. So Yale has had a diabetes nurse practitioner master's program for a long time. And Teachers College is now starting with their first cohort. I'm not sure it's actually started yet. It's about to start, I believe, in September, mm-hmm. where they will have a master's in diabetes management, mm-hmm. which I don't think it's just for nurses at all. I think it's any health discipline can take it.
Oh.
So that's interesting. And mm-hmm. I believe there's one in Kansas as well. So there are several that are just for diabetes. Mm-hmm. But most people get their training as a nurse or a nurse practitioner, or it could be a physical therapist or a dietitian. You know, there's a number of disciplines that qualify. And depending on their interests, they might do clinical rotations in diabetes because they're already interested, or they may pick it up along the way in their situation. And the truth is that a lot of people who have diabetes, when they're healthcare professionals, often wind up as diabetes experts because they know more about it because they actually do it. So that's another way. In other words, a lot of diabetes educators actually do have diabetes, far more than the general population, because wherever they were working, they knew about glucose monitoring, they knew about insulin pumps maybe because they were on one and so on, so they become the resident expert. Once you decide to specialize in diabetes, it's encouraged to take a certification exam. So the most common one is the CDE exam, Certified Diabetes Educator, and it's offered by the National Certification Board for Diabetes Educators, NCBEE. And they do a very nice job with an exam for entry-level CDEs. It's not for advanced practitioners, but it's for people that have had at least 2 years' experience as a healthcare professional and have done 1,000 hours of direct diabetes self-management education. So they have to have put in 1,000 paid hours, not as part of their training. If someone goes on and wants to become a more advanced certified practitioner, you can get what's called a BCADM. That's Board Certified in Advanced Diabetes Management. And that used to be offered by ANCC in partnership with the American Association of Diabetes Educators, but it's now entirely offered by the American Association of Diabetes Educators. So you have to have an advanced degree. You have to be master's prepared to take this exam. I believe it's for nurses, dietitians, and pharmacists. And you have to have at least 500 clinical hours in diabetes management within the last 3 years of when you take the exam. So I have both of these certifications, the CDE, which is more recognized and known, and the board certification in advanced diabetes management.
Great. Good. What could a patient with diabetes expect from a consultation then with you?
Well, I think that the diabetes nurse very often handles the appointment very differently than some of our colleagues in other professions, where we spend a lot of time talking to the patient and getting to understand what it is they're actually doing and what their difficulties are. So a large bulk of my first visit is asking people things like, tell me from the time you get up in the morning till you go to bed at night what you do to take care of your diabetes. And their response is very telling to me. And once I get all this information, it helps me to know what their knowledge deficits are and to build on their difficulties to try to find ways that I can make the regimen easier for them and something they're more able to follow, that they can do it correctly, safely, and often. And that's really the challenge. So we're talking about what management means, why it's important to do it, practicing the skills that you need in order to perform the self-care, and then most importantly, the next step, which is key, is how they can integrate performing these behaviors into their everyday life. If you don't go that extra step of integrating the regimen into their lifestyle, you have a very high likelihood that the patient is going to go home and not do anything differently than before.
Right.
I'm sure you, I'm speaking to the converted here.
Yeah, and it was nice to hear a nurse talking, Jane, because I hadn't heard knowledge deficit since I retired in 2000. So I'm glad that term is still around because it was a useful one.
Let me just point out, though, that you have not actually retired.
No, not really. But
no, not really.
Different.
I don't think nurses ever do.
Right. I'm teaching the public now instead of classroom of nurses.
Well, it's a very big classroom you have.
But I don't get much feedback now. I used to get feedback from the students, but I don't get much feedback from the public. So it's quite different, but I enjoy it. Jane, your website says that the typical American breakfast is carb, carb, carb. What do you suggest to replace the blood sugar spiking cereals, pancakes, bagels, muffins, and juice?
You know, this problem is really specific to American breakfast, too, and many other countries' breakfasts are not like this, unfortunately for us. So the important method of meal planning for people with diabetes, and I would go so far as to say even for pre-diabetes, is to limit your carbohydrate servings with each meal and space it out throughout the day. So breakfast, lunch, and dinner, three main meals, well spaced apart, should limit the carbohydrate servings to between 3 and 5 servings per meal if you want to control your blood sugar and, as most people need to do with diabetes, to lose weight.
Mm-hmm.
If weight's not an issue, then you might even be able to have much more carbohydrate if you're taking insulin, for example, and you can take care of it, if weight's not an issue. But that's not the case for the majority of the people that I see. Most of my patients do need to lose some weight and mm-hmm. are having some difficulty keeping their blood sugar well controlled. So I usually recommend between 3 and 5 servings per meal, which is the equivalent of 45 to 75 grams of carbohydrate per meal.
Mm-hmm.
So what does that look like? Every 15 grams of carbohydrate or one serving is the equivalent of one slice of bread.
Oh.
So what I'm saying is, for breakfast, you can have the equivalent of 3 to 5 slices of bread.
Mm-hmm.
You can translate that into oatmeal or cold cereal. You could have a serving of fruit. You could have English muffin, milk. Whatever you have mm-hmm. to total it up
mm-hmm.
so you don't exceed the total.
Mm-hmm.
So there's other foods that you can then supplement your breakfast, which don't challenge your blood sugar, such as proteins.
Mm-hmm.
So things like eggs, cheese, nuts can be added to the breakfast to fill you up, make you feel satisfied. And they're also good nutrients.
Mm-hmm. Good.
It's not so bad. It's really not.
Yeah. It doesn't sound as bad as the diabetic diet used to be.
No, it's much different and much simpler.
Mm-hmm.
And I practice what I preach.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have diabetes, but I feel this is a very healthy meal plan.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, Jane, one of your awards was the New York Times Tribute to Nurses Award for Innovations that you received last year. And the award was given to you for developing an interdisciplinary diabetes care council and nurse committees at New York Presbyterian Hospital Weill Cornell Medical Center to address coordinating blood glucose monitoring with the delivery of meals and insulin administration, and for also helping to develop a new carbohydrate counting menu for patients. Can you tell us the reasoning behind your concerns and how you accomplished your goals?
Thank you for asking me that, because this is really how I spend the bulk of my time here
mm-hmm.
at New York Presbyterian, and I think it's really important work. So I see my job as making sure that the hospital is diabetes friendly. So everything I ask people to do at home to take care of their diabetes should be available to them when they're in the hospital. And it's tricky in the hospital because there's many things coming their way and patients getting whisked off for tests or going to surgery, and they can eat 1 minute and the next minute they're made MPO and they can't eat. The food that we serve them is not always the tastiest food, you know, not just
mm-hmm.
here. This is a problem in most hospitals, and, you know, the patients may not like the food as much, so they may not eat as much of it, and then they got insulin for that meal. So there's many, many challenges to figure out what's the right thing to do. One of the most important things, which is also true at home, is to coordinate when you check your blood sugar, making the decision then of how much medication to take for that meal you're about to eat, and eating that meal. And that has to be done in that order within a reasonable period of time. But what's a reasonable period of time when you have so many cooks? Think about how many hundreds of nurses I have checking blood sugars on any given morning
mm-hmm.
here.
Mm-hmm.
So I've established certain policies which say that you cannot check a blood sugar more than a certain period of time before the meal. You cannot give the insulin more than a certain period of time before the meal. One of the biggest problems, for example, is breakfast. Breakfast happens to come along at the change of shifts when nights is reporting on the patients and going home and the day shift is taking over. I'm sure you remember that
mm-hmm.
in your nursing career.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a good time to be doing extra things.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, that's when the breakfast trays come. That's when people wake up, and that's when the patients are hungry to eat. So you can't ask patients to sleep later or get up earlier, and you can't tell them when to be hungry. That's the natural time when people get up. So we have to accommodate that, and it's sometimes tough. So many times, for example, the night nurse will do the blood sugar as the last thing that the nurse does before they give report, giving the day nurse time to get report, and the trays come up and immediately give that patient insulin before they eat their tray.
Mm-hmm.
So you see how tricky this can be, but
right.
It can be done, and it is done.
Mm-hmm.
So by creating two committees, one's an advisory committee where we sit and talk about everything we do that's related to the care of people with diabetes, the medications we choose, the delivery devices we choose to give these medications, the food that's on the trays, the menus that the patients look at to make their selections, and how friendly those menus are for them to select the right amount of carbohydrates. Imagine you were in the hospital, and I told you that for every meal, you could have 4 servings of carbohydrates.
Mm-hmm.
And then I gave you a menu, and it didn't indicate which foods even had carbohydrates.
Mm-hmm.
So how would you make your selection?
Mm-hmm.
You would probably circle things as best you thought was right, and then it would go downstairs to the kitchen, and your tray would come up, and half the food you circled would be missing because you may have inadvertently circled things that were inappropriate. So our menu is extremely clear. Next to every food that has carbohydrate, it tells you how many servings it is.
Mm-hmm.
And on the top of the menu, it tells you how many you're allowed to have. The person that helps you mark the menu, we call them nutrition assistants, has been trained in making sure that the patient selects the right amount, and if they start to go over, they're informed that they've gone over, and they've asked which thing they want to eliminate. That way they don't get the surprise when the tray comes up of somebody down in the kitchen deciding, well, you have 5 servings, you're only allowed 4, I'm going to take away the yogurt. And maybe you really wanted that yogurt, and you would have been happy to give up the whole wheat toast.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So all of these things are very important decisions that patients make at home. I want them to make the same decisions while they're my guest in the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And we spend a lot of time thinking about that.
Mm-hmm.
We give the rapid-acting insulin and a very easy-to-use insulin pen so the patient can learn how to use the insulin pen. So if they do find out they have to go on insulin, they can practice it while they're here. They can give their own injection every time. And by the time they go home, I hate to use this analogy,
mm-hmm.
but it would be a piece of cake for them to take insulin
mm-hmm.
because they will have practiced the skill and they will feel safe to do it at home on their own.
Mm-hmm.
So these are all very important things that have to be considered and looked at all the time. And people that I work with are very helpful in letting me know if something is working or it's not working to give me the opportunity to bring people together that are involved in whatever it is and try to fix it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's always a work in progress. Things change all the time.
Right.
And we have to be on top of the latest delivery devices, the latest needles. I'm just now going to a thinner, smaller needle. I'm sure patients will be very happy with that. But recently came out in a safety device. So it's very important to stay on top of things like that.
Mm-hmm. Great. Now, Jane, you said, I believe, that you help the patients adapt their new regime to their situation at home before they go home. And this requires teaching and motivation. And from my experience in public health nursing, I found that the teaching came pretty easy, but the motivation not so easy. And I would go back and visit again, and often it was discouraging because patients weren't doing what I thought was best for their health. And you notice I say what I thought. Have you learned certain things besides the adapting the whole regime to their situation at home? Have you learned other things that help with the motivation?
Well, I think that, first of all, and research supports what I'm about to say, one of the ways that really ensures that the patient will perform the behavior
mm-hmm.
is when you build a relationship with the patient.
Mm-hmm.
So building relationships, the same person as much as possible working with that individual patient will really help. And that's one of the reasons that telehealth has become very successful. Most of the telehealth programs make every effort for the same person to call each time as much as possible. And some of these programs, one that I'm aware of in the Bronx here that's very successful, the patient actually never physically meets with the nurse. It is entirely done through phone. So the telehealth programs that use the same nurse on every phone call, and most of them make an effort to do that, are very successful. They can lower patients' A1Cs without ever meeting them, just by coaching them over the phone. So you can motivate the patient if you can take away some of the biggest barriers to them performing the behavior. And if I had to pick two big barriers to performing self-care behaviors for diabetes, I think the primary one is the concept of self-efficacy, which was originally not in the health belief model. And the health belief model is a terrific model for people with diabetes because what happens with the health belief model, as I'm sure you know, you worked in public health, is that the patient is making a decision about whether to perform a behavior based on the benefits of performing that behavior and the barriers to performing that behavior. And the barriers are really what is the deal breaker. The barrier is the single best predictor of whether or not that person's going to do it. So my job is to find out what are their barriers to performing that behavior, try to break down those barriers as best we can together, because sometimes when we put our heads together, the patient on their own won't come up with a solution, but us together generating a list can come up with solutions that they can choose from. And then the next part of it is that they feel that they have the ability to do that correctly and safely. So if I don't take care of the self-efficacy, they're going to go home and be scared, and they're not going to be likely to do it. If they don't get to practice insulin multiple times with me watching, if they don't get to check their blood sugar using the meter that they're going to take home multiple times with me watching, then they're going to feel that they're not doing it right or they're not sure how to do it, and they're going to have some discomfort that might actually stop them from doing it. And that is very important. The last piece of that that's equally important is whether this plan has been individualized to look at this person's daily schedule and figure out ways to incorporate this into their schedule. So this is a very simple, almost ridiculous example of why many people don't check their blood sugar before lunch. I find when I look at logbooks, if a particular time of day is frequently not done, that there's a very good reason why that person isn't doing it at that time. And lunch is a prime example, because checking your sugar at lunchtime during your workday almost 100% of the time means you have to carry your equipment with you, right? A lot of people might not want to do that. So if the problem is they don't want to carry it to work, they're afraid that something will happen to it, that they'll lose it, it's annoying to carry it, whatever, simple solution is to give them an extra glucose meter. Give them one to leave in the office. Or if they never check on Sundays and they always go to their mother's for dinner on Sunday, a lot of people do that. They have family meals at one location. Give them an extra one to keep there. So looking at where it's missing and you're not getting information helps you to learn what you can do to try to resolve that problem. And the other reason, for example, with lunch that somebody might not check their glucose at lunchtime is because they don't have privacy at work. They may work in an open area or open cubicle where someone can see them doing it. They don't feel comfortable with that. Or the restrooms in their office might not be private. They might be public stalls where they don't want to put it down by the sink and have someone walk in and see them doing it. So I don't know. I haven't tried to do my blood sugar in a bathroom balancing the meter on the toilet paper roll, but I imagine that's not easy to do. But that's things I hear from patients, and I get that. That is hard. So coming up with other ideas, or letting go of something that's very difficult for them and rewarding them for the times they do check rather than focusing on the times they don't check is sometimes a really good motivation for them.
Mm-hmm.
But the key thing about motivating someone to perform the behavior is to be talking to them about the outcomes of that behavior.
Mm-hmm.
If someone is checking their blood sugar and taking an insulin dose based on that blood sugar, you better be going over the dosing they're taking, the blood sugars that they had, and the blood sugars they had later, and seeing if it's working.
Mm-hmm.
If someone comes in and shows you a logbook with glucose values that they've been doing, and you open it up and look at it for a second and barely comment on it, how long is that person going to keep checking their blood sugar?
Right. Right.
I wouldn't.
Right.
So you make the behaviors that they're performing important parts of the visit, things that you want to probe and discuss, and then you give it great value.
Mm-hmm.
And you're making treatment suggestions based on the information that they're giving you.
Sounds
great. That motivates people.
Right. The one problem that I see is when I worked at Bellevue, a lot of the patients that we had did not have a home to go to. And I worked again with the homeless population here for about 25 years.
Wow.
I imagine that creates a big problem when you have a diabetic patient that does not have a home to go to. I don't know if you've been in that situation or not.
Oh, a lot of times here.
Have you? Are they able to work out a way to take their insulin and do the things they need to do to get the diet they need and...
You know, it's on a case-by-case basis, depending on what their resources are. I've had people in shelters where I've been able to actually negotiate with the shelter to provide more appropriate food for them.
Mm-hmm. Oh. Mm-hmm.
It was the kindness of the cook at the shelter to mm-hmm. do that for me.
Mm-hmm.
I've had situations where I'm concerned about the storage of their insulin,
mm-hmm.
especially in New York. I live in New York in the summer weather when it's, you know, very hot.
Mm-hmm.
Can be an issue, so we have to come up with ideas about, you know, what they're going to do. One person sleeps on the steps of a church midtown,
mm-hmm.
and in speaking to one of my social workers trying to figure out a plan for this guy who needed to be on insulin, desperately needed insulin, there was no other option for him, I learned that there was a mobile van that goes around New York. It's somehow funded by the Department of Health, I think, I'm not
mm-hmm.
sure, that goes around to different strategic locations and dispenses medication to people
oh.
who are homeless,
mm-hmm.
and they do go to that church steps.
Oh.
So wasn't that great?
Yeah.
Sometimes we have to think mm-hmm. about how can I get some samples, how can I get some donations.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I try to do the best I can, but it's very difficult.
Mm-hmm. Jane, what about the psychosocial aspects of diabetes care with clients?
Well, part of the assessment with patients is to identify, for example, depression is much more common in diabetes. Could be a chicken or an egg story. I'm not
mm-hmm.
sure.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
it's not really known. But I think it's very important to think about depression and screen for depression when you're caring for people with diabetes. And the reason I say that is think about if you were feeling depressed and feeling sad, would you want to get up and check your blood sugar
Mm-mm.
and take insulin and eat a healthy meal and go do some exercise? I don't think so. So depression is one of the main barriers to performing self-care.
Mm-hmm.
So if that's not identified and the patient is not referred for treatment, it's very difficult for the patient to do the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very important that we pay attention to that. The next thing is, we have to spend less time talking to our patients and more time listening to our patients.
Mm-hmm.
When I sit and listen to my patients' stories, I am just amazed sometimes at how hard it is for them to live with diabetes and how tired they get of it sometimes and how they need vacations from it and how upsetting it is when well-meaning friends or family do things that don't support them, but in fact make it tougher for them. For example, imagine going to a party where none of the food that's being served is appropriate, even though your host knows that you have diabetes?
Mm-hmm.
What if all the desserts are desserts that would not be good for you? Well, you know, there's a simple solution to that. I'm all about empowering the patient.
Mm-hmm.
You can't change other people, but you can change yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're going to a social situation like that, find out what the person is serving, call ahead, and then bring things to fill in where
mm-hmm.
you feel your challenges are.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So if you know that the desserts are not going to be appropriate, bring an appropriate dessert for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
It's very easy to do things like that, and then you know there's always something you can have.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very important mm-hmm. to listen to our patients and find out exactly how tough it is and how we can help them.
I think we spend so much time in nursing on interviewing and probably not enough on the technique of listening. Because I don't remember ever talking about listening as a student. But
I did.
Oh, did you?
When I was an undergraduate in my very first nursing class at NYU,
mm-hmm.
I will never forget this. The very first class we had, we talked about communication. And we were told to go out in New York City
mm-hmm.
and talk to a stranger.
Mm-hmm.
That was probably the hardest assignment I had ever been given, because from the time I was born in Hell's Kitchen in
mm-hmm.
New York City,
mm-hmm.
my mother told me not to talk to strangers. And here I was being told at school to go out
mm-hmm.
and talk to strangers. And we all had to do this. We were given several hours. And then to come back and say what happened.
Mm-hmm.
And we all went out and just really listened to people.
Mm-hmm.
And it was wonderful. It was just a wonderful life-changing experience for me to do that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I really got the message they wanted me to get. That shutting up and listening is oftentimes more therapeutic than talking.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, NYU is good. Because I told you I did my baccalaureate there, but I had also gone to a diploma program prior to that, so I think I had a certain mindset before I went there, and I added on to that, but I don't remember a lot about communication skills beyond interviewing in my basic, and then what was in the RN to BSN program. I don't remember communications being a part of that either.
So. Nursing Science 1A.
Oh, is it? Well, see, this
was
when Martha Rogers first came, and she was teaching epidemiology. So there was no nursing science at that time. This was back in 1954, 55.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So there was no Nursing Science 1. This was pre-Martha Rogers science courses. So a lot has changed, thank goodness. Now, can you tell us about your research focus, Jane?
Well, I have done several things recently. One I've completed, one I've just started, and I do have some things in the works. So
mm-hmm.
my interests have a lot to do with clinical inertia. So clinical inertia is the failure to advance therapy despite obvious reasons why you should. In the case of diabetes, when a patient has an A1C above 7%,
mm-hmm.
the next step is to bump up whatever treatment they're on to the next level. If you've tried everything you can, you've tried to improve their meal planning, you've tried to increase their activity level, and you've done the best with the current meds in optimizing them, then the next step would be to bump up the therapy. And what often happens is, if the next obvious step is to initiate an injectable, especially insulin,
mm-hmm.
a lot of patients are very resistant, unwilling. I'm not quite sure exactly what the right word for that would be, but they don't really want to go on insulin.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes, especially I think in primary care, where they don't have as many diabetes educators to send patients to, and the physicians are kind of left on their own with this, this can go on for years.
Mm-hmm.
The average person with an elevated A1C in the United States, if the A1C is over 8%,
mm-hmm.
can take 5 years or longer to go on insulin.
Mm-hmm.
And if the A1C is between 7 and 8%, it can take 10 years to go on insulin.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is a really big problem in this country.
Mm-hmm.
So my area of interest is educating healthcare professionals to feel more comfortable and confident in initiating and intensifying insulin therapy. And I'm particularly interested in using problem-based learning or case-based approaches to teach them how to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of clinician education is lectures that talk about studies or actions of medications, but doesn't really get into how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's really important that we teach people not only the science, but the art.
Right. Right.
So I did do a study using problem-based learning with nurse practitioners, and I'm happy to say that it was very successful in increasing the likelihood of them initiating and intensifying insulin therapy.
Mm-hmm.
I'm now working on using a very simple order set to order insulin and anything someone would need for diabetes in the hospital electronically, that auto-calculates the doses of insulin
mm-hmm.
based on the patient's expected requirements for insulin. And we've had wonderful changes in blood sugar since we launched this order set November
mm-hmm.
1st.
Mm-hmm.
There's been a 50% reduction in low blood sugar since we did this. There's been a great reduction, I don't remember the exact number, of high blood sugar, and much greater percentage of patients fall in the target area that we want them to be between 70 and 180.
Mm-hmm.
So this is just wonderful. Just by giving the clinicians a very simple, easy way to order the diabetes diet, blood sugars, insulins, everything, all in one order set together.
Mm-hmm.
Very comprehensive,
mm-hmm.
but simple.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the challenge. But the last area, which I'm just beginning to work on some projects in the early stages, is about transition of care.
Mm-hmm.
How can I send the patient home safely into the community to ensure that they're not going to wind up back in the hospital or the emergency department
mm-hmm.
anytime soon?
Mm-hmm.
And there are a lot of strategies that I believe will help me to be able to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm developing some tools that I will then teach the clinicians to use, and we will pilot it and see how it does.
Mm-hmm.
It's all good.
That would be a great thing to do, I think.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate this very much, Jane. It's been very interesting to me, and I know it will be to the public, and I hope we can talk again.
I do, too. This has been wonderful. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you again, Jane.
Take care.
Yeah, you, too. Another uplifting issue of a distinctive style magazine filled with heartfelt stories about people whose passion in life is to help others can be found in the new summer issue. In today's media, with an emphasis on hurricanes, floods, fires, volcanic eruptions, global economic problems, social unrest, and other negative problems, these uplifting stories provide some positive energy and help us to realize that not all is wrong with the world. There is a good mix of stories, music, and movies in this issue, and one focus includes stories of recovering survivors of 9/11 in memory of the upcoming anniversary. Patricia Welch also sings United We Stand, written by her husband, Pete DuBerry, to describe 9/11. Enjoy the beauty of the Northern Lights movie, shot over 6 months in Norway, or read about toys that assist development in autistic children, or read about Sam and Amber Jagauer, both actors who maintain a happy home life in Hollywood and work with instead of against Mother Earth, or read about Brooke Burke, co-host of Dancing with the Stars, as she describes her new book, The Naked Mom, A Modern Mom's Fearless Revelations, Savory Advice, and Soulful Reflections. If interested in health, you will want to enjoy the movie on Firewater that exposes the truth about the harmful effects of industrial-grade fluoridation chemicals used in the water supply in Australia, or read about toxic chemicals in skin and hair care products, or view the movie about citizens fighting to protect their environment from coal mining, where the weekly detonations are shredding the landscape, poisoning the water, and devastating the community. These are some of the stories you will find in the summer issue of A Distinctive Style magazine. I know you will want to subscribe to this magazine at www.adistinctivestyle.com. My second guest is Dr. Julie T. Chen, an integrative medical physician who is board certified in internal medicine and is also fellowship trained and board certified in integrative medicine. She has her own medical practice in San Jose, California, is the medical director of Corporations Wellness at several Silicon Valley-based corporations, is on several medical expert panels of websites, as well as nonprofit organizations, is a recurring monthly columnist for several national magazines, and has been featured in radio, TV, newspapers, and magazine interviews. She incorporates many types of healing modalities into her practice, including but not limited to medical acupuncture, Chinese scalp acupuncture, clinical hypnotherapy, strain, counter-strain, osteopathic manipulations, and biofeedback. To learn more about Dr. Julie, check out her website at http://www.makinghealtheasy.com. I welcome you to the Holistic Health Show, Dr. Julie, and I look forward to hearing how you work with diabetics.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Dr. Julie. Now, first, what are the blood sugar parameters that constitute pre-diabetic and diabetic?
Usually the pre-diabetics are seen in the fasting blood sugar ranges of about 100 to 125. Above 125, you would be considered a diabetic. But in my own practice, where I really like to look for the pre-disease state, so, for example, more like a leaky faucet before it overflows kind of a problem situation, mm-hmm. I start to caution patients when their fasting blood sugars start to get into the middle to upper 90s or even into the 90s, depending on their other medical disease states. And that usually I'll even classify as more like a glucose intolerance or starting to have some confusion as far as cellular understanding as to what the insulin signal does, so that they don't then all of a sudden go straight from somebody telling them, you're fine, then all of a sudden they're pre-diabetic when it hits 100. Mm-hmm. So I really start to caution patients when they start to get into the middle to upper 90s.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Then, Dr. Julie, what does glucose intolerance mean?
It means when your cells are, so there's a signal in the body. Our body has the ability to recognize certain signals or hormones or chemicals that signal for cellular functioning. And so insulin is a signal that the cells get to help metabolize sugar, to put sugar away, to utilize it, et cetera. And so when we start to see the signal of insulin but not quite know how to utilize that to get the sugars out of the bloodstream into the cells so the cells can utilize it for fuel, that's how I usually explain it to my patients as far as what glucose intolerance means. It's mm-hmm. that you're intolerant to or you're intolerant to the sugar signaling, and there's an insensitivity to the insulin signal itself, and so there's a lot more sugar in the bloodstream than it's supposed to be there.
Mm-hmm. What types of food do you recommend for your diabetic patients?
I usually recommend, and I go over heavily on the lifestyle and nutritional aspects with the diabetic, in the sense that we go over what is considered low glycemic loads or low glycemic index foods. And what this means is how quickly when we eat something, our body sees like a spike in sugar or its ability to take that sugar, take the food that's ingested and have that be metabolized into sugar and then to put away into cells for utilization. And so if a certain food comes into our body, we eat it, and it's an immediate sugar spike, that's a high glycemic load, which means that our body sees a massive amount of sugar all at once. That over time tends to cause a confusion in the body as far as putting you at higher risk for insulin insensitivity or glucose intolerance. So I usually will recommend for my patients to eat foods that are higher in fiber, harder for it to break down into fast loads of sugar so that it's a slower release. And those foods are usually low glycemic load or low glycemic index foods.
Mm-hmm. Can you give some examples?
Sure. So for example, foods that are higher in fiber, a lot of the vegetables tend to be lower glycemic indexes. Foods that are high in sugar, for example, I'll just take banana.
Mm-hmm.
So a banana, when it's green, has a lower glycemic index or load than when it's really ripe and yellow and sugary. And
mm-hmm.
so what that means is that even within one food itself, the banana itself, from a green state or unripe state to a ripe state, the sugar load or the glycemic index load or glycemic index can change within that one food. The reason is just that same thing that I talked about before, is that when the food is consumed, if it's seen as a high sugar spike all at once, it's considered high glycemic index. And if it's a low, slow release of sugar, then it's a low glycemic index. And so an unripe banana would be seen when you ingest it and it's digested. The sugar spike is much slower versus once it's really, really ripe, it's a lot of sugar that it can immediately be released into the bloodstream. And that's why it's considered a high glycemic index food.
Mm-hmm. Then, Dr. Julie, are there foods that help with the glucose intolerance?
There are foods that are helpful with sugar management in the system. So, for example, we have some indications that vinegary foods tend to help with sugar metabolism, as well as certain spices like cinnamon and foods that are bitter, bitter melon, kale, things like that tend to, Swiss chard, they tend to help with sugar control a little bit. And in general, what I recommend for diabetic patients is to eat a diet that is much higher in vegetables, less in the sugary foods, and even less in fruits compared to vegetables, primarily because it's hard for diabetics and a lot of patients to know which fruits are safe and which are not. And so I usually will just recommend more of a fiber, plant-based protein-type diet, more vegetable-based diet for my diabetic patients.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And what about nuts? Are they able to eat nuts?
Nuts are fine. Again, depending on the severity of your diabetes and your kidney functioning, you don't want too high of a protein load because too high of a protein load can be a strain on the kidneys.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, a good amount of protein within the diet is important. Nuts are something where there's a lot of other nutrients above and beyond, whether there's sugar or not. It's got minerals and vitamins and healthy fats, omega-3s, and all of these can be beneficial for a lot of the comorbidities for diabetics. So not just something that I would recommend for patients to eat if they have some sugar sensitivity, just not, of course, massive amounts of any types of foods.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Dr. Julie, are there supplements that you use with your clients?
Yes, there's definitely, so some of my patients can't, the amount that you need to eat to get enough things like cinnamon, bitter melon, or things like that, a lot of patients don't like to consume that much amount of those foods to get the better sugar control. So frequently the supplements I'll put some of my pre-diabetic or diabetic patients on might be the bitter melon and the cinnamon. There's some indication that chromium might help a little bit, but again, we don't know the exact implications for high levels of chromium in the system that's above and beyond what we naturally need. So I usually recommend about 100 to 200 micrograms of chromium. Again, all of these are meant to be adjunctive and helpful to a low glycemic index, low glycemic load diet. So no amount of eating poorly can you then think that the supplement will take its place and fix the problem. So you have to eat well first and foremost, make sure that your diet is going to be beneficial for the diabetic state. And then these supplements can theoretically help. And again, you know, having some vinegary foods or bitter foods will help as well to help control with the blood sugar. And what's important really is to focus on not just popping a pill and thinking that that's going to fix
mm-hmm.
your medical condition.
Mm-hmm.
It's really thinking about eating the foods, using food as medicine to help you with your medical condition. In this case, we're talking about diabetes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm always very interested in compliance. And I know that this is sometimes a problem with diabetics, with hypertensives, and with others that have severe health deviations. Are your patients pretty compliant? And if not, are there certain things that you do to help gain compliance?
Sure. And that's a great question because I think, you know, in my practice, I'm fortunate enough to be getting the types of patients where they're really seeing me to get healthier. So in essence, there's a self-selection of the perfect patients mm-hmm. that end up coming through my clinic because they really are seeing me because they want to get well. So there is their own level of motivation, internal motivation already coming to see me. So in that sense, a lot of the compliance is easier. But having said that, when we do lay out the actual game plan on how to get healthier, of course, a lot of the things that they need to change, especially if they're not already doing it, may be very difficult for them, and hence compliance for those specific areas of getting healthier might be difficult for them. And one way that I usually will get my diabetics and patients with other chronic diseases to change their lifestyles or their nutritional intake is one, very, very importantly, is to help the patients understand why they're doing it. Because if they don't understand why they're doing it, they're not going to do it. They're not going to make those steps and those changes that are to them initially difficult to make and disruptive to their lifestyle. So a lot of education, patient education, goes into this in helping them to understand not just why they're doing it, but how it might positively impact their life long term, including finding out what activities or certain aspects of their life that are important to them and how making this change could potentially help them get there. The other thing that I do is, especially with nutritional or lifestyle changes, is for them to keep a journal. And over time, they start to see in their own writing and pattern and helps them to actually recognize the change instead of me telling them the change that's going to occur. They actually see it themselves that when they eat a certain way, they usually have increased energy or decreased symptoms of shakiness or et cetera, or their numbers start to look better. So it becomes almost like evidence for them to see in front of them with their own eyes that, yes, in fact, there is a correlation between making these changes and the health benefits. And then when we sit down in clinic and we go over the journals together, I then further emphasize the benefits of how that led to improvement, meaning if the numbers start to look good, I ask them, well, that day, do you remember, were you able to do more? Did you have more energy? Were you able to do X, Y, and Z that you wanted to do? And by doing it that way, it drives the message home that they really are benefiting and they are really living better by living this way, even though initially the change may have taken a little bit more effort, but over time they start to see that the change is not so difficult and that they really are reaping substantial, tangible results from doing it.
Mm-hmm. These are great suggestions because I know that this is often a problem. And
making it a personal thing for them really helps for them to realize that this is their lifelong change that they reap the benefits from and that they're doing it for themselves. And when they're able to see that, it really makes a huge difference.
Mm-hmm. Now, Dr. Julie, is there anything else you would like to say about diabetes or the people that you work with that have diabetes before we look at your products and how the listeners can locate them and reach you?
Sure. I really want to encourage diabetics out there to see it as something that you can live with long-term and live well with still, because you do have a lot of control over how the disease affects your life, in the sense that a lot of things, the nice thing is that there are things that you can do that can change the course of the disease. And I have personally had patients in my clinic where they've gone from diabetic down to actually normal numbers. And so it's something that patients frequently, one of the main things I encourage them is to feel empowered to know that you have a significant role in making yourself healthy and that you can, in the situation where you're given the diagnosis of diabetes, make a change so that you're healthy again. And so there are steps that you can take, and I don't want any of the listeners out there to feel like there's nothing that they can do and that they're just sitting there victims of the situation, because there are, and you should definitely reach out to your physicians and nutritionists and find out what ways that you can go about taking control of the situation and feel again like you can live the lifestyle that you want.
That's great. Now, then, would you tell us about your products and how the listeners can reach you?
Sure. Actually, starting this fall in September, my company is Making Healthy Easy. That's E and a Z. So Making Healthy Easy. We're coming out with a product called Making Healthy Easy Immunity. These are immune supplements that I give to my patients all the time because I have a lot of autoimmune patients or patients who get sick frequently. And so really, these supplements have been great in helping my own patient population and my family members and helping them to keep serious infections at bay and to really help them to feel better. And so the way that you're going to be able to get this product is through my website at www.makinghealthyeasy.com, and that's makinghealthyeasy.com. And through that website, you'll be able to also see all my magazine articles and interviews. And I will be appearing on Cron 4 as the exclusive in-house physician starting this fall for a show called Days with Zara. And we'll be talking a lot about health issues on that show as well. So to learn more about the product and the different shows that I'll be on, you can check out the website at www.makinghealthyeasy.com.
Great. And congratulations on your new position.
Well, I definitely believe in what I do. I've seen so many patients do well, and that's something that I think is important. And that's why I even named my company Making Healthy Easy, because I do want people to know that living healthy and being healthy doesn't have to be hard.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I thank you very much, Dr. Julie. This has been very interesting, and I know it will be helpful to the listeners.
Thank you so much for having me.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I thank you for joining me today. I am Dr. Carl O'Helvey, your host, wishing you a great week.